William O. Douglas said, "As nightfall does not come all at once, neither does oppression." In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged. It is in such a twilight that we must be most aware of the change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness. And he's describing that phenomena, which I don't know if it's true in biology and zoology, of the frog cooked in the pot. That old saw that you can cook a frog in a pot by putting it in comfortable weather and slowly raising the temperature until it succumbs to unconsciousness and then death. And I think oppression, absence of the rule of law, corruption, is a similar experience, like nightfall, like twilight, like a frog in a pot. We see that very disappointingly in this week's parasha. As you know, I am not one to whitewash our patriarchs, our ancestors. Our sages were wont to do that. My children frustratingly have consumed the Midrash that when Esav went to kiss Jacob, which I think showed Esav's maturity and Esav's level of patience and forgiveness that Jacob couldn't show, there's a Midrash to defame Esav and to speak approvingly of Yaakov that what Esav was doing was biting. So I do not like to take our stories and make them more simple. But if I can, I like to gather and stress what is most, if not alarming, then certainly discomforting, and raise that discomfort to force us to think. Frankly, that's what good stand-up comedians do also. So we have this, I think, somewhat horrific series of about a dozen, two dozen verses in chapter 47 as Joseph uses his power to exploit the wealth of the Near East, gather to himself and to his immediate clan and family the power, strength, and wealth of the Egyptian Empire. So in a period of penury and starvation and hunger, he first collects dollars, collects taxes, and then when the people can't pay for their tax, Joseph collects their livestock and gathers them to presumably the capital. When they can no longer pay with livestock, he takes lien on their land, and then they become serfs and then effectively enslaved. He makes population transfers, moving people around such that they are, I think the trick is really it diminishes a power base. So, for example, what I observed in Africa is that people in senior positions of government leadership were never in their home territory. So if you had a Bamileke tribe person in the West where their families were, they could have a power base. But if you threw them to the Muslim North to be the prefect, they had no power base. They couldn't resist. So I think that's part of what's happening. There's population transfer. Rashbam, that's verse 21, Rashbam compares it to Sennacherib, the Assyrian who brought the Israelites to the first exile. The population transfer is not, Rashbam says, Rashi's grandson, does not recognize it as a kind of heinous act. Already in the roughly 11th century, he's not comparing Joseph to a hero. He's comparing him to one of the great villains of our tradition. And there is another value to this suggested by our sages, that by transferring native Egyptians across lands, it makes the Israelites less susceptible to accusations of foreignness. If no one is in their home territory, it's no big deal that foreign Israelites are also there, for good and for ill. So I think the more difficult pieces are that the Egyptians express gratitude for their servitude, and they willingly contribute a 20% tax on their produce. And there is this tragedy in the moment of the Egyptians becoming willing serfs, and the Israelites simultaneously settle in Goshen, becoming significantly wealthy. I don't want to suggest that anti-Semitism is ever appropriate or has true cause, but we have in our narrative, at the very least, the seeds of the problems of the first chapters of Exodus, the resentments that will occur centuries later. And what our tradition does very interestingly, I think, is that the personal becomes a microcosm for the political. That we understand in the rabbinic tradition, and even intimated in the Torah and Haftarot themselves, that things that are happening to one person or to one family are lenses through which we can view national developments. So in the Midrash, in Tanhuma, which is a Midrash on many parts of the Bible, it offers many examples of things that occurred to Joseph that likewise happened to Tzion, to the land and homeland of Israel. I'll just give you one example. So it quotes in our Parsha of Genesis, or actually a few parshiot ago, that Joseph was beautiful and fair to look at, and in Psalms, Zion is described the same way. And it goes on to find these linguistic parallels, which I think is the point I want to elucidate a bit today, that our Torah makes political commentary by narrowing the focus to the personal, that those things are understood to be fractal patterns, or the microcosm and the macrocosm, and both valid lenses and heuristics through which to view history, our people, our scripture. And I think Joseph comes out much the worst in this parsha, not just in the section that I read to you, which I've always been found very painful. I mean, the gradual despoliation, the gradual degradation of the Egyptian people by our leaders. And of course, later in Torah, they are Egyptians more so than Moabites or Edomites are acknowledged as our brethren. That in, I think by Deuteronomy, they're described not as our enslavers, but as our hosts. Seems a bit of a Stockholm syndrome, but let's. And in various places, we get the sense that Joseph, somewhat in the earlier parshiot, sort of as a callow and vain youth, has really lost his way. There's a counter tradition that Joseph has maintained his righteousness, but in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, it notes, and I always am suspect of rabbinic math. They are very loose with their numbers. But it says that 10 times Joseph heard his brothers refer to his father, that is Jacob, as your servant. That is inferring, or implying, I guess, that Jacob is servant to the son. Totally inappropriate subversion of hierarchical parental norms and parental respect. And in each of those 10 times, say Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, one of the early Midrashim, he didn't protest. And for each of those 10 times, his age, his lifespan was reduced by 1 year. Which goes to a very consistent traditional approach that our duty, at the very least, is to protest. That if we find ourselves in the twilight of an oppression, we at least must speak. And there are a few greater deeds that we could do in the twilight of an oppression in difficult or dark times when we see people being, if not enslaved, at least immiserated, at least oppressed and subjugated, or being reduced to an underclass, as it seems the Egyptians are in this parsha, and of course the Israelites will be in two parshiot. So Jacob has misgivings about going south to Egypt. And it's told him that, don't worry, your sons will close your eyes. Your sons will, presumably, you know, they will be there surrounding your deathbed. But Rashbam, again, Rashi's son, says that expression doesn't necessarily mean eyes, but your affairs, your needs. That Joseph and his brothers will take care of you in old age. You know, if you understand pre-modern systems, the welfare state was really having a lot of kids. And once you got too old to farm or to do commerce, your sons, and to an extent your daughters, mostly your sons because your daughters would become part of another family unit, were there to provide for you in old age. That's clearly understood to be a duty, to provide for the infirm and the aged and the vulnerable. So beyond speaking up, in an era of declining rights, in an era of economic, I would say the Gini coefficient going up, if anyone knows what that means, which means that inequality is spreading. In an era, if rule of law is diminished, not only do we speak up, but we take care of. But again, that seems to be the most nice things our sages say about Joseph, and that there are people in the story who come out even better than Joseph, that Joseph is actually the minimum. But the next higher level is Judah, interestingly enough. So at the denouement of the Joseph saga, which is one of the largest sagas in our Torah, and I've said many times, actually the largest surah in the Quran, interestingly enough. And they borrow from Midrashim that we have, just on a parenthetical literary and religious note. At the denouement of that story, when they confront or recognize each other, it says that Joseph couldn't restrain himself, which sounds sweet and vulnerable and effective, but the Midrash, also Tanhuma, says, the confrontation between Joseph and Judah, what was this comparable to an ox who was running about, like an ox in a china shop, and all the animals were fleeing from it, for it was kicking one and butting the other until the lion appeared and the ox retreated. Those are, for those who watch Game of Thrones, the idea of an animal representing a person or a symbol is current, because Joseph in the next parsha will be likened to an ox and Judah to the lion. Meaning if there's disarray, not only is it your job to speak against and to attend to those who are victimized, but actually to confront. John Mulaney, one of the great stand-up comedians of our age, I don't want to tell you what this metaphor is about, but you'll understand it as we go. He describes a thing being like a horse in a hospital. How did the horse get in the hospital? And yeah, the hospital was inefficient, but does a horse make it better? And suddenly the horse can fire the animal catcher. And some days you don't hear from the horse at all, which is almost worse. So I'll let you infer what that metaphor is about. But some days you have to stand up to the horse and or to the ox in the Midrash. So those duties in confronting a twilight period of speech, of attending, and of confronting, Joseph and Judah are these levels, but the highest level is their father. So Israel, once convinced, Yisrael, Jacob, descends, comes down to Egypt, follows his children south, and he makes a pause in Beersheba. Anyone been to Beersheba? Oh, not my favorite town in Israel, my second least favorite town. It's a dump. Less so now, but when I was growing up and my uncle lived there, I'm trying to think of what. Lafollette is nicer. Like I'm trying to. There was a city in LA that was very comparable to. It was called Chatsworth, and we used to say Beersheba is the Chatsworth of Israel. But since you don't live in Southern California, Lafollette isn't comparable. But it is not my favorite city, although it's grown and it's got a university now. It's doing much better. But he stops in Beersheba, which is an odd, I mean, it's on the way. It is a way station, but it's not clear to our sages why that would be mentioned. He's just making a trip. You don't necessarily say if you were to travel from here to Seattle, you wouldn't say, I'm going to Seattle by way of Charlotte. No one cares, right? So Rabbi Nachman in the Midrash says, he went to cut down the cedars that Abraham had planted in Beersheba, which I can't think of what Parsha is, but there's a line where they dig the wells and they plant. These cedars were then taken along with the children of Israel when they left Egypt, and they used to build the Mikdash, the sanctuary, the Mishkan. Which I think is so cool. Like the idea that you plan ahead. I mean, of course it's Midrash. It's our sages' desire for all things to be interwoven. So it's unlikely that was what's intended, but I like the idea that not just that everything is interwoven and that everything is interpenetrated in meaning, but they're thinking ahead. They're planning. They're looking forward. They're thinking about how to reinforce the structures, how to tighten the bolts, how to look ahead and ensure that, the future will be brighter than the present, and taking positive steps now. And I think, so again, there's Joseph's level, there's Judah's level of direct confrontation, and then there's the level of looking to the future and ensuring that the future is an improvement, that the vulnerable will not be taken advantage of, that the inequities and inequalities will not grow, but that there will be a time. This whole thing's been about Venezuela. I don't know if you've got what I'm actually talking about. My whole point today has been about Chavez and Venezuela, Maduro. No, but it is also about those things. I mean, there must be people in Venezuela who are thinking to a day, rather than leaving, who are thinking to a day when this can be made better. You know? And that's a part of our duty. What? Pardon?
Buenos Aires.
Yeah. Good luck. But those are the things we do at all times, not just in times of twilight oppression, but at all times. Speak up, attend to those in need, confront and plan. You know, and whatever your political stripe might be, that's good advice for civic participation. That's good advice for Jewish life. That's good advice for congregational organization, and it's good advice for personal growth. Speak up, look to, stand up, and plan.